Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our news editor, Jordan Farley.
I'm vengeance.
Hello. Oh, there he is. Oh, sorry. Masked Man there. We might be talking about that a bit later, because this week we're talking about The Batman, and we're reviewing that, Clio Barnard's Bradford romance, Ali and Ava, and mountain climbing documentary, The Sanctity of Space. And we'll be hearing from Jeffrey Wright, Paul Dano, Andy Serkis, and Colin Farrell about their roles in, Jordan,
The Batman.
The Batman. Okay, so before we get on to all of that, apart from The Batman, what have you been watching? More deep, sort of voiced, gravelly, intonated drama?
Not me, no. I caught up with Uncharted this weekend. I managed to miss it when it came out. But I have to say, I enjoyed it more than I was expecting. I'm a huge fan of those games. So I went in very skeptical. Tom Holland is obviously significantly younger than the character as portrayed in the games. And Mark Wahlberg appears to just be playing Mark Wahlberg and everything nowadays. So, you know, isn't going for any kind of characterization. But
apart from Father Stew, it's his best performance he's ever done, he tells us.
Yeah, in the new issue, we spoke to Mark Wahlberg about his new film. And apparently he paid for that film all by himself as well. So he cut the check, as he says. So he clearly believes in that. But I thought it was a great deal of fun. I was really genuinely surprised by how much I enjoyed it. And one of the more kind of inventive final set pieces I've seen in a film in a long time. Really quite enjoyable.
Yeah. Holland is dominating the box office. Who knew? Matt, what have you been watching?
And I've got the really annoying answer, because I've seen two things in the last 24 hours that I'm not allowed to actually say I've seen yet. One is Hard Embargo, and another one, this is a weird thing about embargoes. Maybe this is a good thing to share for some of the listeners who don't really understand this kind of stuff. But sometimes we see films and they're embargoed, meaning we can't review them until a certain agreed upon date, which is, you know, fair enough. But then sometimes you see films where the social embargo is lifted, so you can kind of tweet whatever social sentiment, but you can't actually review it. So, you know, you can't share a star rating, but you can do loads of tweets, basically. So I don't know if I can even mention the one I saw last night, but I won't, to be safe. But I'm sure we'll be talking about it on here in the not too distant future.
Yes, we will. Yes, and if you're clever enough, might be able to work out what it might be later in the chat. Okay, I have been watching Inventing Anna, which Jordan and I adored the actual feature that was about. But I'm not so taken with the show. Have you seen it, Jordan? The actual narrative of it seems to be getting away from the excitement of the reading the actual piece that it's based on.
Yeah, I've seen every episode, binged the whole thing horrifyingly quickly. I thought it was decent. I sort of agree with you. I don't think the embellishments add much, if anything. They probably just detract from what made that original article so fascinating. There's a focus on the journalist who wrote it. She's a sort of fictionalized version of the journalist, and she's given this whole backstory where she's written this article that's like caused a lot of controversy, and she's pregnant, and there's all this stuff which is obviously giving context to a character that context didn't exist in the past. And I sort of get why they did it, but it detracts from what I enjoyed about the article, which is just a woman doing crazy things that you can't believe a person would have the guts to do.
Yeah, the balls to just be like turning up just to sit on someone else's yacht and basically run up £500,000 worth of food and staff expenses on a yacht that they weren't supposed to be on. For one example of the things she did. It's fascinating. So yeah, I'm still sticking with it, but I think if you really are interested in con artists with the sort of the Tinder swindler and other things, for this story, I think the original feature is the better thing to look at. Shall we crack on then? Speaking of sort of mysteries and things to unravel, it's time to get your rain togs on, lads. It's time to get to Gotham with this.
Is a tool. But when that light hits the sky, it's not just a call. It's a warning.
You
So this is, of course, Matt Reeves' new take on The Dark Knight, which opens tomorrow, The Batman.
I'm Batman.
Our online editor, Jack Shepherd, sat down with four men who represent very different things to Bruce Wayne in the movie. He chatted to Andy Serkis, Colin Farrell, Jeffrey Wright and Paul Dano about makeup, morality and millennials. First up, Jack asked Andy Serkis about the genesis for his portrayal of Batman's loyal butler and surrogate father, Alfred.
So I'm wondering about your character, Alfred. I mean, we kind of meet him. He's on a walking stick. He's got scars. You know, what's the backstory there? Did you create something with Matt Reeves? How did that process happen?
Matt wrote him as someone who needed a stick to walk. And it was really to sort of give a back history of his service in the army. And then, you know, sort of moving on, leaving the army as a result of that and going to work for Secret Service. And then becoming a close protection officer. So there's a sort of trajectory there, that a back history that Matt had sort of inbuilt, and we discussed that. But it's a way of introducing the kind of tension in Alfred's character, which is someone who isn't good at dealing with the messy world of emotions, and this particular version of Bruce it sort of exemplifies that. He is someone who is going through it and is not taking any notice of his mentor anymore. So it's not the usual relationship of Alfred to Batman, in the sense that they're both fighting a battle together and helping each other out. You know, he's very much pushing against what Alfred stands for and the history of the legacy of his father, and the guilt that Alfred feels is of course that he wasn't there for Bruce in his hour of need to protect his father. But it's a very messy, complicated relationship they have when we meet them, and that was really appealing, and it seemed very fresh in an interpretation of a relationship we think we know.
They play a lot with the father-son dynamic going on, their kind of stepfather kind of bond. I'm wondering how did you go about developing that with Rob as well? Because I imagine it would have taken you to both be quite like vulnerable in that kind of situation as actors.
It is this sort of unsaid, a younger version of Rob's Bruce would have had respect that doesn't play anymore. And it is like, you know, having a teenage son, and certainly Matt Reeves and I, we're both fathers, and we know what it's like when your children start to pull away and to challenge you, and you know that it's a very complex time when that starts to happen. I mean, having said that, Alfred just isn't and will never be, and that's part of his flaw in his character. He knows he can never be a surrogate father. He only knows how to be a mentor and a teacher. He doesn't have the emotional tools to properly be a father to Bruce, and that really plays out in this version.
Mm. And how do you think, I mean, you've worked with Matt Reeves on the Apes films. Like, how do you think you've seen him develop as a filmmaker and a storyteller?
Wow. I mean, he was always an extraordinary filmmaker way before the Apes movies. Cloverfield and then Let Me In were two great movies. And then he was suddenly thrust into this world of performance capture, and he immediately understood about it was that acting is acting, and you shoot the actors and create the environment to make those performances come alive. And yet he has this wonderful facility for, you know, envisioning a world, writing the story for a start, but also envisioning a world, and the way he knows how to move a camera to access point of view in a story is quite phenomenal. So yeah, he's all round a great, great storyteller on film.
Jack also sat down with Colin Farrell in Burbank, and he's playing Oswald Cobblepot, a.k.a. the Penguin. And first out of the gate, he had to ask him about that incredible physical transformation.
I'm sure you've been asked lots about the makeup. I know you did like 4 hours to start with, and then it was brought down to 2 hours. I'm wondering, was there ever discussion about doing the Penguin differently, about not being in that makeup and just being yourself, or even just putting on a load of weight and doing it?
Well, every discussion until I saw what Mike Marino, the makeup artist, had designed, every discussion, which is probably, to be honest with you, three chats up until that point, were considering the character and the character's psychology, where he was at this stage of his career as a career criminal. None of it was about inhabiting this character that ended up being in the film. I was somewhat bigger when I met Matt. He liked the weight that I had on. I had done a thing called the North Water where I played a whaler, and I had put on quite a bit of weight. And Matt was like, oh, yeah, I love it. Oz, I think Oz is. And I was like, no, man, let's have a thin Oz because I'm not feeling great now and I have to lose this weight. There's no way I was keeping it on, man. And so there, you know, the magic of film, the bodysuit, padded, you know, pillows and things. And so it, once I saw Mike Marino's design for the character and I knew that Matt Reeves was really excited about it. And when I say design for the character, I mean, basically I saw Matt, I was in Matt's office in London and he went, you want to see what Mike has drawn? And I said, yeah, come back. And he put his computer, opened the thing and he showed me the face on a bust that Marino had cut into. And it was still clay. It was still brown and wasn't colored at all. And he's like, yeah. What do you think? You like it? And that was the first time that I knew that I was going to be totally submerged beneath poundage of makeup. It was such a blast, man. I felt somewhat untouchable in it. You know, I mean, you get such license to have absolute freedom of motion and expression and articulation of thought and feeling. It was really, really cool. I had no idea what I was going to do without that makeup. And then when I saw the makeup, the character, everything, the way the character moved, the way he sounded. And also there's a sense of history when you look at that face of Oz's. It's so cut up and so pockmarked and you almost pity him. I mean, it's quite scary looking and it's quite an imposing character, but there's also something that's almost sympathetic to it as well, which I think is part of Mike Marino's genius that he created that. So as far as I'm concerned, I can't claim full ownership of this character. Like if I get good reviews, I will. If I get shite reviews, I'll blame the makeup artist. But nowhere to be found, you know.
Did you have that version of the character like in yourself and you thought, I want to be like this kind of mafioso, Sopranos like mob boss? Or did you see the picture of him and then go, actually, that is what I'm going to bring to that? Because
I had thoughts, and based on conversations I had with Matt and the script, I knew that he's a career criminal. And then when I found out about how he was spending his days and at what level within the criminal organization Oz was at this point, because he's not fully embodied the archetypical power of the Penguin that we know. He's at the earlier stages of his career as a criminal. So I had ideas. I'd done a lot of dialect work with Jessica Drake, my dialect coach. We had dialed in on a particular sound and a particular pitch where the voice was going to be and all that kind of stuff. So that was all close to being 100%. I kind of knew where I was going with that, but I wasn't fully comfortable with that until I saw the makeup. And when I saw the makeup, I just all became really, really clear. And the first day we did a makeup test was out here in Burbank, a few miles from where I am now in Los Angeles. And it took about 6 or 8 hours and it was about 12 people, 10 or 12 people. Someone was there that had molded the teeth. Someone was there that had done the hair. Mike Marino and his team were there. 3 or 4 of them were applying different pieces because it was 6 or 8 different individual prosthetic pieces. And once it all went on, honest to God, it overtook me, as I think it would most people. And yeah, it was like being a kid again. I started adopting a certain way of moving and talking and gesticulating with my hands and just felt like being a kid in a sandbox, man. I mean, I have not had this much fun, just unbridled fun, you know.
It's proper dress up, like, you know.
It really is. And I mean, that's, you know, that's what the job is. I mean, look, there can be days on a set if you're doing heavy material that can be quite intense. And you can find yourself as an actor sometimes, depending on what you're doing, of course, but it can be quite upsetting or it can stay with you. Sometimes it can be hard to shake off. But essentially, you are playing dress up. You are assuming the energy and the behaviors of the other to tell a story. And so with that in mind, I mean, this was that on steroids, you know.
And Jack caught up with the two sides of Gotham's criminal coin, Jeffrey Wright, who plays Lieutenant Gordon, and Paul Dano, who essays the Riddler.
I want to start with a question for Paul, because the Riddler is like a twisted guy, I think it's fair to say. I was wondering, what was your process of getting into the character of like Zodiac killer meets unhinged millennial?
Luckily, Matt's script was shockingly powerful, and along with being an incredible mystery, sort of immersive spectacle, it was quite powerful emotionally and psychologically and thematically. The first conversation him and I had were about hero and villain and sort of the two sides of trauma, and that Batman is born of trauma, and in this film, so maybe the Riddler. So that's really the seed from which everything grew, was trying to make it as sort of personal and emotional as possible. Yes, Matt had referenced the Zodiac Killer, but that was only so potent for me. It wasn't Bible And although I think the film makes contact with reality, which is part of, I think, its power, again, for me, it wasn't as much about thinking about any peoples at large as it was going to the source of this guy's pain, which I think is the thing that then becomes unleashed. And yes, he's, I suppose, twisted, but it was important for me, whether this comes across or not, that it wasn't just nature and born some twisted psycho, but that nurture or the lack thereof in this city of Gotham, which I think is a sick city, is part of what created this person.
It's a very realized Gotham as well. It feels so abstract because it shares so many cities and that kind of thing. I mean, Jeffrey, your Gordon is like, he's Gordon before he's Commissioner Gordon. He's definitely not new on the scene, but he's still finding his way perhaps more than we've seen in other iterations of that character. So I'm wondering, was that the draw for you? Was that something that you felt that you could put your mark on?
Well, I think Matt making him lieutenant activated the character in a way that was interesting for me. And it really allowed this partnership with the Batman to come into and come into the center of things, because Matt wanted to go back to the origins of Batman and celebrate the character as the world's greatest detective, which is how 80 years ago the story began. And so that is at the core of our film. And I think in some ways what differentiates it from previous versions that we focus on that side of things. So then that Gordon is still very much a cop on the street. It gives him the opportunity to be involved in the dirt and crime that is Gotham. So that was a really wonderful door to walk through for the character for me, and something that maybe we haven't seen explored before to the extent that we do in this film.
I mean, you both give really brilliant performances, but I imagine it must feel quite strange because, I mean, it feels like a very intimate film despite having such a big budget and big sets and all that. I'm wondering, how did Matt Reeves kind of cultivate that feeling on set where you could give an explosive performance of as the Riddler, or, you know, a kind of quite intimate relationship with Batman as Commissioner Gordon?
Well, I think you're right. In some ways, there's like a chamber piece going on with this huge immersive film at the same time. And I think there's such a loneliness in Gotham to sort of each character's mission or journey or whatever. But I think some of that just also comes down to the fact that the characters are fully realized characters. They're not just the archetypes at work and on a, there's not a surface level. There's a lot going on underneath, and everybody's fighting for their own life in some way. And so I think maybe the layers that Matt gave us the opportunity to explore on the page and then in his direction and on his set and in his world, I think helps to create some of that sort of intimacy, which I think also has to do with maybe like immediacy in relationship to the characters.
And I think as well, the ways in which Gotham is realized in our film is comprehensive. There's a world built that feels so complete and inviting, I think, for audiences. And for example, when the vista that we've seen in the trailers of looking out over the city from, you know, this elevated, floor and skyscraper, looking out over the city, you can imagine life going on in those spaces. And I think what our characters do and what we were asked to do is to represent that life on a personal psychological level. So this is a real place. This is fantastical, yes, but there's something authentic and real about this. And we inhabit this city. And the wonderful thing about the Batman is that he's not an extraterrestrial. He's not, doesn't have superpowers. This isn't a film about Batman in space. He lives in a city that's very much like the city that I live in America, New York City, which is what Gotham was fashioned after. So it gives him a certain accessibility as a superhero that is maybe unique from the others. And so the film, our film, really digs down into that. And it's a film about about ordinary lives in these kind of mad, exceptional situations, and in this city that's going through its own type of trauma. And it's a city that doesn't look too unfamiliar to us. It's something that we feel. And I think the humanity of the characters is born out of that closeness to who, you know, who we might be in, you know, outside the cinema.
Scratching the surface of the movie as well, but I've been told to finish. But I'm going to say thank you very much to you both for speaking to me, and I hope you have a great rest of the days. Enjoy London.
So how do all these chaps play into Batman's world in this iteration? Matt, tell us what's going on in this new Batman.
Well, in case anyone didn't know, this is a kind of ground up reboot for Batman. So this is like a completely new, you know, I mean, it's a completely new take on Batman. It's not connected to any of the existing films. So we're sort of starting fresh here, and we're finding Batman and Bruce Wayne in the second year of his Gotham project, where he's basically going around being Batman and trying to sort of see how that works for him. And as to how these people fit in, Paul Dano is the Riddler, and he's kind of sort of driving the narrative in the sense that he's kind of committing these murders, leaving these clues for the Batman. And he's kind of a very, very disturbing and very mysterious figure in the background, but he's what's really driving the plot forward. Jeffrey Wright is Lieutenant Gordon, and he's, you know, he's kind of just building his partnership with Batman, as we see in this film. And they're kind of one of the great parts of this film. I think the kind of double act between those two, but a lot of this investigation is going on together. Gordon's obviously getting a lot of heat for helping out this weirdo vigilante, but he carries on doing it anyway. And then you've got Colin Farrell, who's also sort of on the fringes as this new version of the Penguin. He's sort of like a lower level gangster who clearly has ambitions, but he's not right at the top of the tree like Carmine Falcone. And then lastly, Andy Serkis is obviously Bruce's loyal manservant, Alfred. They lean into his military side here a bit more, and he's kind of proves to be very useful when it comes to helping Bruce crack some of these puzzles that the Riddler's leaving.
So it's a detective story then, isn't it, this one? That's the sort of aim of it. Does it work? Does it work as that, rather than being a sort of, you know, more of a superhero story?
I would say yes, absolutely. My favourite element of this film actually was the fact that it's trying to live up to the fact that Batman is supposed to be the world's greatest detective. It's one of his comic book monikers. It's something that the films to date haven't necessarily lent into particularly. This is heavily leaning into a Seven kind of vibe. The structure of the entire detective story is pretty much wholesale lifted from Seven, to be honest, which yeah. I'm not complaining about the slightest, because I think it works wonderfully well in that regard. I wouldn't say it's hugely complex in that sense. You know, Batman gets a few like ciphers to decrypt from the Riddler, which leads him to the next thing in quite a satisfying fashion, but it's not like he's solving complex puzzles and whatnot. Like, it's not like the ultimate detective movie. But I thought within the confines of a superhero film, I really enjoyed the fact that it was trying to do something a little different, that it wasn't just going, we got to chase after the bad guys now. It was investigating crime scenes. It wasn't literally dusting for prints, but there's an element of going from A to B, which, and connecting the dots between, you know, these various crime scenes, which I found just quite gripping and I found it entrancing, especially the first, like, well, this is a long film, but the first like hour and a half, I thought.
I mean, we should mention this is 3 hours of this. Is there enough meatiness to be going for 3 hours?
There was for me. Like, I actually found, because I've seen it twice and it sort of flew by for me on second viewing. And it is long, but if you go and prepared, make sure, you know, you don't take too big of a drink in with you. I found it fine over that time frame. But how about you guys?
I sort of agree with you. I too have seen it twice now. The first time, I would say that it felt too long for me, especially the final act, which we're obviously not going to go into details about. It felt like a scene too far, a set piece too far for me. But the second time watching it, when I knew what to expect a little bit more, I didn't mind that it was 3 hours. I just kind of enjoyed being in that world for that length of time. So I think it might actually be a film that benefits from subsequent viewings, if you don't mind putting in 6+ hours into,
yeah,
into the new Batman.
I've only seen it once. So for me, I felt it was too long. I felt there was an obvious ending that was presented And then we got another ending and another ending. And I wasn't entirely sure that I couldn't have had those bits saved for the beginning of a new film. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I think this film is hugely successful and will spawn many others. I mean, I think Robert Pattinson doesn't have to worry. I know he sort of said he'll be watching Twitter reviews with a sort of sickness in his stomach, trying to see if everyone likes what he's done here. But, you know, I don't think he has to worry. He's going to get this job again, isn't he? Obviously, this is a guy's movie in terms of the people we've talked about so far, but there is a very key woman in this. Catwoman, played by Zoe Kravitz. She is absolutely fantastic in this, I found. Just so sort of catty, and I know that sounds silly, but she is like a cat in as much as she's duplicitous. She wants to be stroked and then she's going to scratch you. She has fun, you know, she's lithe, she can jump on boxes, she jumps off buildings, she can ride a bike. She's incredibly capable and doesn't give many F's, does she? And I really like that about her. Obviously, Michelle Pfeiffer is the iconic one, but is Zoe Kravitz wiping Michelle off your memory board for this?
I would have to say not even close, to be perfectly honest. I thought Zoe was perfectly decent. My issues were with the depiction of the character, really. I didn't think there was enough to Catwoman in this film that felt different from what we've seen before, especially Anne Hathaway's Catwoman in The Dark Knight Rises. I felt like it was just taking a lot of the cues from that interpretation of the character. That said, I did really enjoy her performance. I thought she was very physically adept. She has a couple of really strong fight sequences. She's so like fast and lithe. I thought all those elements worked quite well. I just felt it wasn't anything particularly new, and that was a little bit disappointing to me. But I did think she had okay chemistry with Robert Pattinson. Thought it was going to be a bit more, don't know, because there's a love story element of this which emerges between Batman and Catwoman, as has been depicted in previous films, and I wasn't totally sold on that either.
I think that's a bit harsh on the chemistry. I thought they had good chemistry between them, and yeah, like while it doesn't reinvent the wheel, this interpretation of Catwoman, I did come away thinking, yeah, like I definitely like to see more of her in, you know, future installments, whether that's spin-offs or sequels. And it does feel like there's quite a lot of space left for the character to grow, because Selina Kyle, and obviously we'll all refer to her as Catwoman, but I don't think she's ever referred to as Catwoman in the film. So she hasn't fully taken on that sort of, you know, role yet. So be interesting to see what they do with her as it moves ahead.
Yeah, she's just got the little balaclava with the pointy bits, hasn't she? So it's sort of her profile of her head is a bit catty, but nobody ever calls her that.
She's got a lot of cats as
things are strays.
And yeah, and she is concerned about her kitties being okay in her flat. So there's lots of pointers to that. Let's talk about Robert Pattinson then. Obviously, you know, very famous for another franchise. He was the sparkly vampire in Twilight. He's gone way away from that with all of his recent roles, like crazy sort of roles and working with really sort of interesting filmmakers. Most recently, Robert Eggers for The Lighthouse. He's come back into franchises with this. What do you make of his Batman? I mean, he's very emo, isn't he?
Yeah, he puts the goth in Gotham. Yeah, I really liked him. I loved his Batman. He's got a great voice, all important, of course. It's the one element that Bale fell down on, of course. I really like just how much of a kind of brawler he is. Previous Batman, I've always felt they're not under a great deal of threat from average street thugs, but I felt like, oh, this is a Batman who's just a guy in a suit. He gets beat up a lot in this film, which I actually found quite refreshing and enjoyable. But he also seems extremely tough and is obviously very capable of taking care of himself. I was less impressed with Pattinson's Bruce Wayne, I would say. I found the emo element of that character a bit less engaging than I did when he was the man in the suit. I said this in my review, but I think Matt Reeves shares that opinion as well, because he's in the suit for good, I don't know, 75% of this film, it feels like. It feels like we get very little Bruce Wayne in this film, particularly compared to Tim Burton's Batman and Batman Begins, obviously. It felt like
we don't get Playboy, do we? We don't get the Playboy at all. We just get this moping, odd-haired, you know, guy who's sort of moping around and saving children occasionally at funerals, but essentially we don't see the fun side of Bruce Wayne, the sort of the mask that Bruce Wayne wears when he's out and about, which Bale tapped into so gleefully. Yeah, Matt, what did you think about it?
Yeah, I must admit, I felt very, very similarly to Jordan on that front. And similarly, I just loved that there was so much Batman in this film. Like, as a Batman fan, and as someone who just absolutely loves the Nolan trilogy and just won't really hear a bad word said about them, the one thing I've always sort of, that you don't get loads of Batman, basically, in the Nolan trilogy. As much as I love the films, and as much as it works because it is that sort of the three-film structure and everything, I just sometimes wish for a little more. Like, I just would like to have been able to spend more time with Batman in that world. So this, because it feels quite aesthetically sort of similar to the Nolan world in a way, I just kind of appreciated getting a bit more Batman time, really, to be honest. I really liked that element of the film. There's just absolutely loads of Batman in this film. And he feels like the main character. Like, we mentioned all these others, but it does feel like he is the Batman, the main character here. And all these other characters, they kind of populate the world. And it does feel like a very kind of deep, broad Gotham. And just the way Gotham's realized is just very impressive in this. Like, a lot of it was filmed in Liverpool, and there's a lot of kind of digital elements to it as well, I believe. But it just looks so impressive. And I love that kind of aspect of it. And again, that was one of the benefits of the 3 hours to me, that you kind of just get to spend a real lot of time in this world and in the seedy clubs and the back streets.
What about his car and his gear? I mean, one of the things I liked about this Batman is, as you said, it's year two. He's just getting to grips with it. So he's got like just creaky combat boots that he's bought, you know, online or whatever. He's got this mask that is clearly, you know, put together. He's wearing kind of it's a rough, gruff batsuit, isn't it? It's certainly not got nipples on it. And the car is this amazing muscle car, which frankly, I bloody loved the car. I have that car over a Batmobile any day. I like it more than the Tumbler, and that's saying something. What did you think about the sort of kit that he had, Jordan?
It's all very grounded, even more so than in Nolan's films, I think. For example, he has a sort of batarang, which is sort of attached to his chest. But instead of, you know, flinging it like he does in every other film, pretty much, he just uses it to cut some police tape. Like, that's kind of the world we're operating here. There's nothing sort of fantastical or unbelievable about almost every gadget he has, but every gadget has a quite fun practical use. The car is absolutely incredible. It's at the center of probably the best action sequence in the entire film as well. This exceptional chase sequence, which you probably had a glimpse of in the trailer, where he's kind of hunting down the Penguin, and it's the car itself is ferocious. It's just
it has this kind of beast
rocket engine on the back or something, and it kind of screams as it's kind of starting up. It's very, very impressive.
That's one of the very best bits of the film, I think, just when the car's just starting up. And it's sort of, I know Matt Reeves said like Christine, the John Carpenter film, was a bit of an inspiration, but just when it is kind of roaring to life, there's just something sort of scary about it. And it's definitely easily one of the best sort of scenes of the film, that whole car sequence.
I was almost disappointed when he got back on his bike, because he spends a lot of this film on his bike. I thought, oh, you've got such a great car. Can you not drive your car around a bit more?
But the car is a little bit dodgy, isn't it? Like, it's not perfect. This car isn't perfect either. It conks out at a key moment, and he has to sort of give it a bit of a kick to get it going. And I like that element to it as well, that this isn't perfect. None of this is perfect. It's rough around the edges. It's dirty. It's grotty. It's, you know, not quite perfected yet. And so it does feel like there's, you know, room to grow, as you said. Let's talk about other people that are in this. We should talk about Peter Sarsgaard and John Turturro as well, because they are key here. And I loved John Turturro in this, didn't you? Like, I mean, we've seen him do sort of threatening and horrible before, but there's a real level of menace here. And I love the fact that he's also wearing a mask of sorts. He's got these sort of tinted glasses on all the time, even in the darkest nightclub, because he is also, you know, a vigilante of sorts, doing his thing in his underworld area. Really enjoyed that. Did you like them as well?
Yeah, we should say, of course, that Turturro is playing Carmine Falcone, who is traditionally a very powerful kind of underworld figure in Gotham. He's sort of been kept a little bit secret in this film, I think. He's not really present in much of the marketing. We spoke to him for our cover feature a couple of months back, but I feel like I haven't seen many sort of interviews out there with him. So I don't want to go too deep into his kind of role in the story, but I thought I really enjoyed his performance. I just thought he was, another kind of terrifying element, almost scarier than the Penguin. Mm. Like, the Penguin is Carmine's right-hand man, and you can absolutely see why Carmine Falcone is the boss and the Penguin is in step with him. I really enjoyed him, and he's a surprising character in this film. I would say he has a lot of secrets.
I absolutely love Peter Sarsgaard in it as well. He plays like the DA, Gil Coulson, who's sort of a new character. He wasn't in the comics or anything. And he kind of only really has a few key scenes, but he's just so good. And I could have actually done with more of him in the film if they could have made the running time a bit longer. But I enjoyed both those. And both of those particularly sort of, to me, speak to this fact that we haven't mentioned as well that in the UK, this is a 15 certificate as well, which means, you know, you would always expect this sort of film to be a kind of top out at a 12A. But I feel like 15 is fair for this because it is a very tough film in that sense. And just tonally and throughout, like, there's not loads of kind of blood per se, but just the kind of sustained tone of it, that this kind of themes that come up, you know, the things that are hinted towards, the things that sort of happen off screen.
There is mutilation in it.
Mm. Exactly, yeah.
You see the aftermath of mutilation.
Yes.
Yeah. You don't see digits being cut off as it happens. We should stress that.
I kind of watched it before knowing the classification, was expecting it to be, this will surely be a 12A, because these sort of big budget films always seem to kind of get away with that because they have that sort of inbuilt, like you kind of expect Batman to be suitable for children, but yes, I would very much say this one isn't really kind of suitable for young children. So
Same rating as Joker. So in the same ballpark as Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, you've got a new Batman film. Quite extraordinary, really, that they've pushed the boat out that far, that they were even allowed to do it. Because, but I admire them for it.
But they do sit well together, don't they? Don't you think that sort of, if you liked Joker, this is a sort of Batman that might, you know, entertain you as well, because it's in a similar vein.
It occupies a similar sort of adult space, I would say, tonally at least. This is so far from, you know, what Joel Schumacher was doing with the Batman films in the 90s, for example, that in some respects it's barely a comic book movie. Like, it's very much like a detective movie, crime thriller first, with a character who happens to be one of the best loved superheroes in the world. I sort of admire that they tried to do something different in that respect.
You haven't spoken much about Riddler. He's very different from Jim Carrey. Is it doing it for you, Jordan?
Yeah, I really liked him. I found him absolutely terrifying. I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say that the film opens with a Riddler scene. And it really set the tone for what the film's going to be, which is extremely, extremely dark.
And not suitable for children again.
Yeah, exactly. And I liked that he has this sort of mysterious mission as well. He's sort of this moral crusader in a way, who's trying to save Gotham from the kind of seedy underbelly, the corruption that's running through it. I kind of like that element. That again, he's another character who has a lot of sort of surprises up his sleeve, so we can't go into it too much. The one thing I wasn't super keen on was his get up. Like, I think
his
I wasn't
gimp
sold
mask.
On yeah, the gimp mask. I wasn't sold on sort of the early glimpses of him, and the film didn't do anything to convince me that it was a particularly brilliant bit of costume design. But apart from that, I thought Dano was terrific, and he has a key scene late on involving Batman, which I just thought was absolutely great. Like, it echoes the scene between the Joker and Batman in The Dark Knight, that sort of interrogation in the police station, in a way where I thought, oh wow, you've kind of gone there and you've gotten away with it. So I admired them for that.
Speaking of scenes, without any spoilers, what scene is the standout for you, Jordan?
Well, I mentioned that mid-film car chase. In terms of action, that's got to be right up there. It was definitely the moment where my pulse was kind of quickening the most, you know. But the moments where I was enjoying it the most was kind of in that opening sort of hour where you're just going from sort of crime scene to crime scene, and he's sort of putting together these clues and finding out where it leads him next. Like, I just found all that stuff just like, yeah, just so like enjoyable and gripping. Like, I just really, really loved all that stuff. And you have Jeffrey Wright's Lieutenant Gordon there as well, who's practically like Batman's Robin in this film. Like, he's almost his psyche. He's there the whole time. They're almost like a double act together, and they're really fun. Like, in a very similar way to, you know, Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman in Seven, they have that almost similar sort of dynamic, that kind of gritty, world-worn double act. Yeah, I really loved all that stuff.
Matt?
Yeah, and besides what we've already mentioned, as a kind of bat geek, I just loved the first proper scene we get very early on of Bruce Wayne Batman going out onto the streets. It's sort of Halloween night, And he's basically just introducing his kind of current circumstances where he's at in the Gotham Project, and he's kind of looking for some trouble to break up. And, you know, you get a glimpse of the bat sign up in the sky and things like that. And I just love that whole sequence. Ever since I was a kid, I almost think in superhero films, you don't see enough of the superheroes going around just doing their standard day job superhero stuff, beating up like low-level goons. Like, then obviously they get into their bigger kind of, you know, missions after that. But I just love that stuff where they're just doing their, you know, their daily grind. And again, yeah, the kind of fighting in this is so kind of tough for a sort of superhero film. It's just completely different tonally to any kind of Marvel film, which obviously has kind of dominated a lot recently. And like the punches, you just really feel them. It just really feels like just so kind of tough in that sense that, yeah, another reason why I'm just not surprised it got the 15 certificate over here.
You actually feel like people are getting hurt in this film, as opposed to, you know, pretty much every superhero film in the last 10 years. This version of Batman is very faithful to the comics in the sense that he has a very strict no-kill rule. He doesn't use guns, but he's clearly putting people in the hospital.
And he's hurt himself. You know, he gets home and he takes his stuff off and he's bruised and scratched and he's beat up and he's knackered. He's been through the ringer on this despite having the suit. These things are hurting. Yeah, I agree. I like that. I really love the scene that you're talking about, Matt, on the tube. Obviously raining, copious rain, creaky boots. And it's just, he sort of appears and you are like, yeah, look at that Batman. Yeah, I can get on board with this. It's immediate. You're immediately sold on him in that scene. And so it's a really amazing calling card scene. And again, as you said, the car chase is cracking. I absolutely loved that. And then there's this sort of scene towards the end that I can't say where it is or what's happening, but it's water-based, shall we say. Just a lot of people wailing on him. And he is helped out by a comrade that I really enjoyed that dynamic in their relationship and I want to see more of. And then, of course, that amazing corridor scene that you see a glimpse of in the trailer, where he is coming down a dark corridor with a load of people with semi-automatics that are just firing. And all you can see is the flash of the muzzles of the gun as they go off, which is illuminating. And it's sort of like a sort of zoetrope effect as he comes down the corridor. It's so cool. It's so cool. A lot of this film, I was just like, that is so cool. The only thing is that I would say that I didn't enjoy in that sort of thing is the score. I found the score really over-amped, like they really wanted to make sure we understood this was a Batman movie, so it felt very sort of ponderous and loud, and big notes were coming out immediately. But you know, later on in the film, the sort of this Ave Maria theme comes into it, which I found really affecting when it was looped with that score. But the initial very, very booming score, I wasn't that keen on. But yeah, a cool film.
I mean, we should say that obviously that score has got a lot of praise from other people. I liked it a lot, I would have to say. I liked it a lot more than you, Jane. It's a very simple kind of four-note kind of theme for Batman. I need to let it settle a bit. I'm not sure if it's anywhere near the kind of level that we had with Danny Elfman's Batman theme or Hans Zimmer's work on the Nolan films. But I did find it very impactful in the moment. I thought it worked for what he was going for.
It does sound a bit like the Imperial March, though, doesn't it?
I've heard that a lot. Yeah,
it's dun 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 dun.
You said it to me straight after the screening, Jane, but I hadn't personally thought that until you said it. But talking of the music, I also love the use of Something in the Way as well by Nirvana. I was just totally overwhelmed by that afterwards.
Yeah, nice and grungy. Good, bit of grunge for a grungy Gotham.
I'll also give, just before we wrap this up, I'll give a shout out to Greg Fraser, cinematographer. His work here is absolutely gorgeous. Once again, obviously Oscar nominated for Dune, hoping he wins that. But he's knocked it out of the park again here. It's such a kind of, such a gritty kind of gothic Gotham. I really love the visual style that they went with here.
So I think we're highly recommending that people get out and see this. Yeah.
Yeah, earmark an entire afternoon and you'll enjoy it.
Okay, so if you fancy a bit of the Batman, it is out in cinemas on Friday. So from Batman to Bradford.
You'd just be a bit overprotective about you and me.
You and just you and me.
You and me?
What, is that a...
It's not a thing.
I'm joking.
Everything you touch, there's no feeling.
separated. We live in the same house, or separate bedrooms. You need something to keep you
alive. Okay, so this is Ali and Ava. Jordan, who are Ali and Ava?
Ali is Adil Akhtar, and Ava is Claire Rushbrook. Ali is he's a British Pakistani who's living in Bradford. Ava is a support teacher, as she's at pains to point out whenever Ali says that she's a teacher. Ali is a landlord. He's a very friendly landlord, as he, again, is at pains to point out. He doesn't appear to do much else other than absolutely love music. He's a sort of failed DJ. He is married to Runa, but they are in the midst of a separation. This is a huge issue because it's going to cause real problems within his family. So they are keeping the separation a secret for now. During a sort of school pickup, Ali meets Ava and they start to develop the seeds of a relationship. Ava has also recently left a relationship. She has a difficult past, which we learn about later into the film. And it's a sort of romantic, kitchen sinky British romance. And I should say it's directed by Clive Barnard, of course, who directed the Selfish Giant and Dark River. And it's set in Bradford, which is where you hail from, of course, Shane.
Yep, it's hometown for me. It is. Yeah, I was on set of this as well. Did a cheeky little visit to the parents whilst I went on set. And so it's kind of nice to see Bradford on screen. We, you know, it has been on screen a lot over the years, but it's often extremely grim and gritty and, you know, miserably northern. And it's kind of nice to see a film like this that has a lightness and shows sort of a community and a warm community and a friendly community who are happy. There is happiness in this, although it sounds quite a bleak premise. So I sort of enjoyed that element of it, but I thought it was incredibly slight, didn't you?
Yeah, similar. I did like it quite a lot, and especially considering this is not a lot happening, I found I was sort of oddly gripped to begin with, in that way that you're just seeing kind of little bits and bobs of the characters' lives and kind of dipping in and out, and nothing wildly exciting or filmy is happening. But I did find I was strangely sort of beguiled by it. And then I liked it, obviously, as it went on and their relationship blossomed somewhat, but it just doesn't go in the sort of typical romance route you might expect. But there was something very, very engaging about the two leads, which kind of kept me hooked in, even if I wasn't ultimately like absolutely blown away by the film. You know, yeah, like you say, it is somewhat slight. And, you know, yeah, considering I'd sort of seen a lot of really positive reviews before seeing it, that perhaps raised my expectations too high. But, you know, I kind of appreciated that it was a lot less bleak than Clive Barnard's previous films. So that kind of note of hope was nice. There's some really, really great individual moments, some really lovely bits. Like, there's some scenes with music's obviously very important to the two characters, and there's sort of a really nice moment where they're kind of listening to music together, but on their own headphones. And music plays a really interesting role throughout. And there's this really great scene where, I don't know if this is anything you've ever faced in Bradford, Jane, but these kids just start throwing stones at things. And then Ali just kind of blasts up the music in his car. And then they all just suddenly stop and start dancing. And I really enjoyed that moment. And there's a lot of nice little, just nice little kind of like tender moments throughout. Even if, yes, I was never completely blown away.
The strength of this is on Adil Akhtar's and Claire Rushbrook's performances, isn't it? They are utterly delightful. You want the best for them as soon as you see them on screen. They're just so warm and such lovely characters. And that is the testament to those two actors and how they've brought those two people alive, I think. Jordan, did it sweep you away at all?
I'm very much on the same wavelength that you two are. I thought it was very sort of sweet, very gentle. I was never totally blown away by it. Yeah, Adil Akhtar I thought was great. I really like the character of Ali. I like the fact that he's this man-child, this kind of puppyish bloke who seemingly doesn't have much to do in his life. Like, he just kind of goes around and fixes his tenants' boilers and drops his tenants' kids off at school and things like this, and then doesn't really seem to have much of a purpose beyond that. I thought all that was quite interesting, and I just like those moments of connection. Like, it's not all that common to see people of this age and people of this background kind of in a romantic movie like this. I thought all that was quite interesting, and a lot of that felt quite authentic. The elements I was a bit disappointed by is when it sort of starts to lean on cliches a bit towards the end, because you have these really interesting elements where Ava's family, her son is a bit of a bigot because it seems his father was also a bigot. There's a sort of almost reconciliation between Ali and Runa, his former partner, and you just know that kind of Ava's going to see this kind of embrace, and it kind of leaned into cliches a bit too much at the end for me, which I was a bit disappointed by, because I thought it was going for something a little bit more authentic than that.
Yeah, that did feel like it was part of a different film to me as well, that moment.
Yeah, very, very odd. It felt like it was going for like Notting Hill or something like that, rather.
Because it sort of, it leans into a weird rom-com trope, doesn't it? And then even as well, it has a scene of the two of them on the moors, sort of tapping into that Bronte-esque Wuthering Heights. So yeah, it sort of taps into those weird things, but then tries to subvert them and doesn't necessarily do so. So yeah, it's a lovely film. It's I mean, my mum and dad up in Bradford will love this, and we'll go and see it, and we'll enjoy it. And, you know, if you're looking for something that is heartwarming and hopeful, this is the one to see. But it's not a sweeping romance, is it?
No.
Unfortunately not. I mean, enjoyable enough, just don't expect to be swept off your feet.
Okay, so that is Ali and Ava, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. Time for a little bit of plain talking now, where we demystify some phrases we hear on sets. What is a crafty, lads? What are you doing if you're a crafty?
Well, crafties are absolutely my favourite people on set, way more than the actors, way more than the filmmakers, because they're the people who work on the craft services table. They give
they're
you the
people
lovely
with the snacks.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to make friends with the crafties, because you're going to get all the best stuff then.
I heard an interview with someone, I just can't for the life of me remember who it was the other day, but an actor or a filmmaker complaining about on-set catering, saying like, oh, no one wants craft services, but it's like, that's literally the best thing about going to a set visit, getting like the hot lunch and the puddings. And
they were clearly jaded.
That's always a highlight. And if whenever we go on set visits, that's always the first thing we sort of report back on, what was the craft. Talk about the film a bit later, but you know, like
what
was the craft services? Yeah, what was the pudding?
Yeah, what snacks did they have? Because like the craft services is, you know, catering is your lunch, but part of that is craft services, which is literally, generally, it's a bench, isn't it, with a tent over the top, full of snacks, crisps, sweets. If you go to America before COVID, in the times before America, go to an American one, it would be like an entire sweetie emporium where you could just pick out like wiggly worms or like anything you fancied,
cereal and make bar,
cereal bar, cake, bagels. There's usually a toaster on there. You know, there's everything. One I went on just had like big jars of Cool Whip. I have to say it like that because that's how Brian says it in Family Guy. But you could just spoon Cool Whip into your mouth, and there was a fruit salad. And that's, people would come over and just do that. Just delicious sweet things. Basically, it's what the whole thing runs on, isn't it? If people are on a sugar low, they're not going to get through the day. You need to put in your little snack bar. So crafties, we love you. Okay, shall we get onto our next film then, boys? Have you got a head for heights?
My life is completely driven by the mountains.
I was just looking for inspiration. I kept on circling back to the Moose's Tooth in Brad Washburn photos.
He's the greatest aerial mountain photographer of all time.
Brad's photography taught me that you could use tiny human elements to convey the scale of these massive landscapes. When you discover a big climb that's never been done, it kind of feels like falling in love.
So this is The Sanctity of Space. What is The Sanctity of Space, Matt?
So this is one of those films I actually went into knowing just nothing about. And because I thought it was kind of a strange title as well, I thought, and didn't know anything about it, I thought, right, I'm just going to go in completely cold here, just see what I get. And what I got was a mountaineering documentary, And so, as you would kind of expect and hope from this sort of documentary, it looks absolutely incredible. We're in Alaska, and the mountain is, or the mountain range is Denali. They're all named after different teeth. And basically, we follow these sort of climbing buddies and explorers who are also the directors of the film, Renan Ozturk and Freddie Wilkinson. And what they want to do, basically, is they want to... These peaks have been kind of, you know, climbed by many people in the past, but they want to kind of climb up and then go across the top of them, if that makes sense, going from kind of peak to peak across the top. What drives one to do that, I don't know. But also kind of weaved into this film, you know, of these guys and their expedition is kind of, you know, flashbacks to the story of someone called Brad Washburn, who, again, someone I wasn't familiar with. But again, he seems like this kind of archetypal explorer guy. He sort of almost reminded me a bit of the guy that Christopher Plummer plays in Up, like that kind of old-fashioned American explorer dude. And he's kind of described, you know, as such in the film. And so we kind of, you know, cut between really, you know, his story and also, you know, the guys trying to do it in the present day. And he kind of pioneered these aerial photographs of the mountains, which kind of inspired a lot of people to, you know, to do the peaks. And kind of, you know, they would draw on these, you know, incredible photos of the mountains and kind of plot routes up, you know, by just drawing on the photos. And so, yeah, so it's basically, it's these kind of two sides of the story, really.
This is a film that comes after, you know, we were all blown away by Free Solo, the documentary about the professional climber mounting the highest peak in Yosemite. And also in the last sort of few months, we've seen 14 Peaks, Nothing is Impossible, which is about the Nepalese climber who decides to do all of the 14 highest peaks in the world within a ridiculously small window of time. You know, climbing Everest usually takes you a year in the planning, and he decides to do all 14 within about 7 months. So it's something we've seen before. How does it measure up to those, Jordan?
I haven't seen 14 Peaks, so I can't compare it to that, I will say. I would say it's suffered slightly in comparison to Free Solo. I think Free Solo is one of the best documentaries of the last decade, so it'd be hard not to suffer in comparison to that. As a piece of filmmaking, I thought, as Matt said, it was absolutely stunningly beautiful. Like, there's some gorgeous cinematography here. In here, the footage that they've captured is absolutely incredible. On that level, I really enjoyed it. The one element about it that I really did like, actually, was the fact that, you know, comparing it to Free Solo, Alex Honnold in that film, he's so sort of single-minded and dedicated. He seems like almost unstoppable. And you obviously have this fear that he's going to fall to his death in the middle of that film. But the fact that he's so all-conquering, it felt like there's something in his psychology that I almost couldn't relate to with him. But with these two, you get a very real sense that they completely understand the danger of what they're doing. You know, there's a point fairly early in the film where they attempt this climb and they just turn back because they're like, it's just too dangerous. Like, we're not going to do this right now. There was kind of a minor snowfall. He kind of drops his axe like that. That's it. We're turning back. I like that they sort of acknowledge that, yeah, this is really, really tough. Like, it isn't like you're watching Superman in this film. It's like they felt more relatable. Like, it felt like if I was going to scale a mountain, this is probably what would be going through my head as well, as opposed to Alex Honnold, who's just like, wow, you're something else. You're just like, you're barely even human. Like, you're completely unstoppable. I love that element. I love getting to know these guys. I wasn't super keen on the whole juxtaposition of the Brad Washburn story and the sort of modern day attempt to climb this peak. It felt like I totally understand why they did it, because, you know, this picture that Brad Washburn took inspired this climb. And they wanted to tell this story, this pioneering aerial photographer. And his work is so impressive and important because he was taking pictures from the sky as opposed to kind of ground level, which is where all the mountain pictures were previously taken from.
Yeah, Ansel Adams and stuff had been doing it from the ground up, hadn't they?
Exactly. So his pictures are just sort of extra impressive because of that. But I thought, as a piece of filmmaking, I didn't think it was particularly well edited together or structured. It felt like you were just constantly jumping back and forth without particular rhyme or reason. And it just kind of killed a lot of the momentum and tension at points for me as well.
Yeah, I agree. I felt the same. I thought there was two very interesting stories here. The Brad Washburn story was very interesting because he's an incredible guy. You know, this man who... was a pioneer in photography, and his photos are still utterly stunning, even many decades after he took them. But also the fact that he and his wife were incredible mountaineers themselves. I mean, she was the first woman to get to the top of a peak, having never climbed before she married him. And he just was like, "All right, do you want to go for a walk up this mountain, love?" And she was like, "Yeah, sure," and did it. And so there's this very interesting story there. But then there's a separate story about the modern climb, which I felt just needed to be just about that, really. But I did love going along with them for this ride. And that's also the other thing I felt was different about this film from Free Solo. Free Solo felt very much like you were watching one man do it and you were very distanced from it. And as you say, there wasn't, you know, have no real understanding or empathy for what he's thinking in that moment. Whereas this, I felt I was traveling with them and I felt their elation when they got to the top of, you know, the moose tooth or whatever it's called, and the eye tooth and the next one. And when they find snacks up a mountain, that sort of thing, which I hadn't considered the fact that the first time they did it, they stowed some snacks at the top of this hill, went back down, returned a year later and their snacks were still there because it was basically like in a fridge. Brilliant. But so there's all that sort of element of it. And, you know, them huddling down at the bottom on this amazing sort of valley that goes beyond these mountains that they're sitting in these tiny tents. And when they've got aerial photographers photographing them at the top of these peaks, they're like tiny matchstick figures on these huge pillows of white snow, like ridiculous sort of, you know, Cat in the Hat sort of Dr. Seuss type mountains. So yeah, I loved all of that. But yeah, like you, Jordan, I didn't think the two bits sat together very well. And I wish they'd just decided to do two different films.
I would totally agree in that respect. But like I say, I just really enjoyed the fact that you're kind of getting into their headspace more than you perhaps have done with previous mountain climbing films. Like I liked just understanding them. You know, they say at one point during the film, one of the guys says that, you know, the mountain is taking more from me than I'm getting out of it. And you really get the toll that these people are going through trying to achieve this climb that's sort of never been done before in that respect. But you also get a very clear sense of what's driving them as well, because the mountain is just so beautiful. It's just so stunning to look at. You can completely understand why people would want to try and do something like this, because I think a lot of these mountains in this range that they're in Alaska haven't been scaled before. Like a lot of it's kind of uncharted, literally uncharted territory. So you completely understand why they would want to do it, and you also get a sense of the toll it takes on them. And I thought in that regard it was really successful. It's just when they try to get a bit too ambitious with their filmmaking, and I think they're probably more accomplished mountain climbers than they are filmmakers.
Well, if you would like to get up a mountain with these guys, it is quite the experience. That is The Sanctity of Space, and that is out in cinemas on Friday and on demand. But you probably should go for the bigger screen because you want to see the scale of those mountains. It's amazing. Okay, it is time now for alternative line reading, and I'm going to do this. This is a little thing from somebody we've talked about already on this pod, one of our cover stars, and I'll probably do it in the style of someone from Bradford. Everything about me invites you in. My voice, my face, even my smell. And if I were to... What? Stop laughing. As if I would need any of that. As if you could outrun me. As if you could fight me off. I'm designed to kill.
I could hazard a guess. I'm not 100% sure.
I could guess in the sort of, you know, play the player, not the game, whatever that rule was.
Well, I was going to go with Twilight, yes, that Edward Cullen, guess I'm too. Guessing. Are we correct?
It is Edward Cullen and his beautiful overture to Bella when she's like, "Are you a vampire?" He's like, "Yes, I am, and I could kill you and eat you." And she's like, "I don't care, because that's what love is." And it sounds like this.
I'm the world's most dangerous predator. Everything about me invites you in. My voice, my face, even my smell. As if I wouldn't need any of that. As if you could outrun me! As if you could fight me off. I'm designed to kill.
Okay, so that's it for this week. But before we go, we should mention that there's another fantastic release out this week. and out today, in fact, and it's our new issue. What's in the new issue, lads?
So in this issue is fronted by the Northman, and our very own Viking Jamie Graham spoke to, you know, everyone important on the Northman, including Robert Eggers, Alexander Skarsgård, Anya Taylor-Joy, about their new Viking epic, which just looks fantastic. So yeah, that's leading the charge. And then we've also got Moon Knight. James Mottram spoke to everyone on that, including Oscar Isaac and Ethan Hawke and the directors. And then Jane, you spoke to the team behind a new kind of nostalgic, emotional sci-fi actioner, didn't you, Jane? What was that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I spoke to the guys who made Free Guy 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Who knows? When did it happen? It was bobbing around for ages. And they've got together again. So director Sean Levy and Ryan Reynolds have got together again for a film that is so Amblin and sort of taps into their sort of nostalgic childhood sort of film loves, but also puts that together with science fiction time travel. I mean, like, who, you know, you got to love time travel, but also with that Ryan Reynolds snark. But actually, it was really interesting talking to him, as you'll read in the feature, because this really opened up a real serious side in Reynolds. He's usually, when you talk to him, extremely snarky and snide and funny and witty and all of the things you would expect from someone who's played Deadpool. But this time around, we ended up just really getting into it about dads and our fathers and the relationships you have with your parents. And he was really, really serious and very sort of honest and not at all sort of snarky about it at all. So it's quite an interesting read if you want to hear about what Ryan thinks about his dad and how that shaped him. What else is going on in there?
We've got The Lost City, which was you again, Jane. You've been very busy this month. We've got chats with Daisy Edgar-Jones, who stars in Fresh, which is a very interesting upcoming horror movie that we'll be talking about in the very near future. A great Matt chat. We spoke to Mark Rylance for Phantom of the Open, which is a hilarious golf comedy, believe it or not. Bill Murray's in there. We spoke to Bill Murray
for Ledge.
Very unusual sort of concert film, which was filmed on the Acropolis. A typical sort of Bill Murray experience, I imagine. So much good stuff in there.
So much good stuff. And that is out now. Run to the shops with your axe, wearing, you know, your pelt of a wolf, because it is the Northman issue. Okay, before we go then, it's time for a reader's question. And this is a good one, actually. I do like this one. Is there an interview where you wish you could go back in time and do it again because it was either so good or it went so wrong? Jordan.
Ooh, that's a tough one. I'm trying to decide whether I want to do the so good or so wrong.
Do you want to admit to us so many wrong?
Yeah, exactly. I haven't done many interviews that have gone horribly wrong, I don't think. There are none that are coming to mind. It's possible I've just, you know, repressed the memories because they were too traumatizing. I would absolutely love to go back and interview Jake Gyllenhaal again. I did him for a tour film interview a few years ago. And he was just such a sort of engaging, interesting guy. Just one of those experiences where I just almost didn't want it to end. I was just really sad when it was over. I could have spent hours talking to him, I think. It's a really compelling, fascinating dude.
There's loads of kind of fascinating interviews I've sort of loved doing that I just love to kind of revisit and let Jordan get another chance to kind of talk to him, just talk to them a bit longer. Again, I don't remember any that have gone terribly wrong. There's one sort of clangor that haunts me that I'm not even going to actually say what it is. But the gist was, I basically said, did X person kind of contribute to this film at all? And then they said, no, because they're dead. And I literally wanted, like, you know, the ground to swallow me up. And it had all been going so well until that point. And they were perfectly gracious about it. But I just felt it was one of the worst moments of my life.
Feel your pain.
I mean, you know, people have requested interviews with dead people before. This has happened, so you're not alone there.
We should say none of us have done that. We're thorough professionals and would never do that. But we might know.
We have
people.
Colleagues who may have done so and put in a request to interview dead people. That does happen. My one would probably be in terms of going well, but also that I wish I knew what I know now when I interviewed them then, is I did Denis Villeneuve and Ryan Gosling for Blade Runner 2049. And obviously when talking to them, I hadn't seen the film. I wasn't allowed to know anything about the film. and they could only talk in very ridiculous sort of non-sequiturs about the film. And I wish I could have talked to them knowing more so that I could have asked them sneakier questions to get more out of them. So yeah, I wish that, because it's always frustrating when you actually see a film. It's like if you do a Bond interview, Jordan, you did the last one, and there's things that you don't know that you're asking them and they're talking around it. And then you see the film, you're like, oh, for goodness sake, if I'd known that, I could have asked you that, that and that. So yeah, whenever you do a Bond one, I remember when I did the Skyfall one, and obviously having a good chat to Judi Dench, and there's questions I would have asked her had I known things that I know now.
Oh yeah, I mean, I did Daniel Craig for No Time to Die, and you know, I think every question I asked him would have been completely different if I'd have redone it now. You know, there's at least a dozen questions I wanted to ask him about the final 10 minutes of that film, you know, which I had no idea about before when at the time I interviewed him.
Indeed. So that is our best and some of the worst that we won't be mentioning, which I don't really think anyone who has a bad interview wants to go back and revisit ever, do they?
It's just the worst, isn't it? Yeah.
I think I've mentioned this before on the pod, but I've interviewed Christoph Waltz before, who is, you know, an absolutely, he's a tremendous actor. Like, can't hold that against him, but he's also a person who doesn't like talking about his character ever.
Yeah.
So he's very difficult to interview. So he's one of the more sort of challenging interviews I've ever done, but I just wouldn't want to redo that because I know the experience would be exactly the same.
I absolutely would want to. I wouldn't want to go back to interview Nicholas Winding Refn either as well, because I did him many years ago for a sort of long form video interview actually. And I had kind of like 15 minutes or so, which is quite long as far as these video interviews go. And it was to kind of cover his career in that time. And just every answer, he was just giving the briefest kind of snippet of an answer and just not willing to go into any depth. You know, he was repeating himself, and like, you know, when I sort of, for example, asked him what was so good about working with Mads Mikkelsen, he was like, he's a great alter ego. And then I said, oh, what did you like about working with Ryan Gosling? And he's like, he's a great alter ego. And sort of blood was like draining my face. But weirdly, once it was all edited down, actually it seemed fine. But in those 15 minutes when I was in the room, it was just a horrible experience.
That's tough. You can never discount the fact that maybe people are having a bad day.
I'm sure
it would be great. Our Jamie Graham interviewed someone for our next issue who is one of his acting heroes, and he was telling me that he interviewed him many, many years ago and had like an awful time with him for whatever reason. And he interviewed him just yesterday as we're recording and had a great time with him. Like he said it was like speaking to a completely different person. So you never know what's going on with a person at the time. It could be anything.
Indeed. I think it must have been a bad day the day I did Samuel L. Jackson. Shall we leave it there, shall we? And on that note, let's say goodbye in our best Batman way. Off you go. Say goodbye.
Goodbye. See you later.
Au revoir.
Ha 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 ha.